Good morning and welcome to the New Orleans Imperative, the radio show that focuses on public education in New Orleans in a privatized landscape. For those of you all that are listening to us for the first time, this is Renard Sanders and I'm your host. And we are here every Monday morning at 10 a.m. to talk about public education and to focus on those issues that are not necessarily in the mainstream media. And we talk about exactly what's going on the ground. This morning, we are broadcasting from Baltimore, Maryland at the Save Our Schools conference. And we're going to be talking about a national organization, which I'm a member of, Save Our Schools, which is a grassroots organization that focuses on preserving and transforming public education as a cornerstone for democracy, for democratic society. This is basically a new organization, and you'll be hearing about the kinds of things that's happening nationally and also what's going on across the country. We're going to be listening to three of my colleagues. My first guest will be Save Our Schools founder, Bess Altwerger, and she will be telling us exactly how this all started. Bess, are you on the line?
Yes.
Hello, Bess? Bess?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes, be here.
Okay. Just speak a little louder. First off, I'd like to thank you for taking time from your schedule to be on the New Orleans. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. I want to thank you for taking your time to be on the New Orleans Imperative this morning. Can you tell us a little bit about how Save Our Schools actually got started?
Sure. Well, in the summer of 2010, We, as a professional education community, were becoming increasingly frustrated and concerned about education policies that we felt were harming the vast number of children in this country that attend public schools, especially in regard to the use of standardized testing and how that testing was being used to close schools and to have harmful effects on the children as well as the teachers. And at that time, one professor named Jesse Turner from Connecticut decided that as an act of protest, he would walk from Connecticut to Washington, D.C. to protest the use of standardized high-stakes testing in our schools. When he arrived in Washington, which is the area in which I live, we decided to have a reception for him and a forum to address the community and help them understand what was so disturbing about the current policies, federal policies in regard to high-stakes testing. And out of that forum and reception came the idea that it was time to join Jesse by the thousands and march in Washington, hold a large rally in the backyard of the White House to let the government know that teachers and parents and students wanted a change in the policies that we felt were leading to the destruction of public education. And so we did, in the summer of 2011, hold a very large national rally of about 10,000 people in the mall in Washington, D.C., and we had, in addition to a march, a wonderful list of speakers and they were parents and civil rights leaders and community organizers and, of course, teachers and teacher educators and students who spoke to the need to change public policy and support public education.
Now, Bess, you mentioned that it initially started as, you know, the issue being the test and the standardized test. Were you talking about just the testing for No Child Left Behind, or were you talking about high-stakes testing that was happening in a particular community or the community that you live in?
We actually developed in the year that was leading to the 2011 rally several demands. one of them being high-stakes testing, and I'll get back to that in a second. But we were also fighting for equitable funding for public education due to the fact that we have grossly inadequate funding in some schools and very adequate funding in others, and that is not an equal playing field in this country. We wanted curriculum that was developed in response to and including communities that were not mandated at the federal level. And we wanted to see parents and community members involved in making the policies that run public education instead of the corporations. Now, high-stakes testing was one that was really forefront in everybody's mind, because right now, over the last decade, especially under NCLB, No Child Left Behind, test scores were being used as a strategy, as a tool to close schools that were not making adequate yearly progress, to, in effect, fire teachers in those schools and go to zero-based staffing, and to hold children behind. And, whether or not testing can be used in a positive way, it was not being used in a positive way in this legislation. And, unfortunately, that continues with Race to the Top. So we feel that testing is the main tool that's being used right now to open charters, to close public schools, and essentially destroy public education as a building block to a democratic society.
So initially, when you guys, really started talking about this, ground level, were you talking about it from a national perspective, or were you just concerned about, and I know you're from Maryland, were you just concerned about just a regional kind of a protest or statement? What exactly was the, let's say, the net, so to speak, that you guys were interested in throwing out there?
Well, I think that these policies, especially the testing policies, harm individual local communities in different ways. What has happened is that communities across the country feel isolated. I don't think always understand that this is a national strategy and that people in communities all across the country are suffering from the high-stakes testing policies that the federal government has instituted. So the SOS, Save Our Schools, was a way to galvanize the individual efforts and the initiatives in local communities so that we gain some support from each other at a national level. We share information. We help each other with strategies to combat what's going on. You have, schools in Detroit and Philadelphia and, Baltimore, of course, here in Baltimore. We have schools that are closing, reopening as private charters. And, we need to galvanize the sentiment out there and the concern in communities so that we can speak with a strong and powerful voice to the federal government that we do not want to see these kinds of policies continued.
Okay, let's do a little housekeeping here. You are listening to SOS founder Beth Hultberger. I'm not pronouncing that wrong, Beth, but
that's
there
okay.
With me. And she is discussing the beginnings of Save Our Schools, which is a national organization that speaks to many of the issues that we have in New Orleans, along with testing, high-stakes testing, closing of schools. If you wish to call in, you can call in at 504-260-9265. That's 504-260-9265. If you're transitioning to a computer, you can listen online at www.wbok1230am.com. That's wbok1230am.com. This particular show, we'll have a couple other guests that will come on from the SOS Steering Committee. that will be joining us will be David Green, who will be talking about his guiding principles, and also the national director, Mr. Bob George. So getting back to the issue, Beth, did you guys really think that it would go off this big initially? Because I know I participated in that first march, and I think we had about 15,000 people that came out from across the country. Did you all think that it would grow as it did that first year?
Ray, we wanted really primarily to change the national conversation about education. Until that march and rally, we did not see in the mainstream media much talk about the resistance to the policies. And we knew that we were not going to get millions of people. We helped for even a larger crowd. There were estimates anywhere from 8,000 to 10,000 people. It could have been more than that. It was an extremely hot day. It was close to 100 degrees in Washington, D.C. The fact that we got that many people was we saw as a victory. What we think happened as a result of that national action was more media attention and more attention even in social media on the issues that we laid out at that meeting. Before 2011, there was very little discussion, very little acknowledgement of the very harmful effects that those policies were having on our public schools. Parents and teachers felt very frustrated that their voices were not being heard. We would write letters to the editors. They would not get published or rarely published, and we couldn't get any attention to the issue. And I feel that our biggest success was that. There is now a national conversation. There are many blogs all over in many on Huffington Post, on Education Week, and elsewhere, that are reflecting the views that were not being heard about in the media prior to the march.
Okay, so it was important, and I think you said something that is key, a national conversation. Why do you feel that was that important?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that, Ray?
You mentioned that, there was you guys wanted to have a national conversation, which and why did you think that was important at that time?
Well, I think it was important because what is happening feels local, but it is national. It affects different communities in different ways. The national policies of making adequate yearly progress, now the Common Core state standards, the PARC and SBAC consortia, which are just heavily federally funded groups of people who are creating national tests that will be implemented all over the country. It feels local, and it does have different local impact, but it is mm-hmm. a national policy. And if we're going to make changes, we need to work both locally and nationally. And there were, as I mentioned, groups of people across the country, especially in New Orleans and other cities around the country, that were working to mitigate the harmful effects of schooling, of high-stakes testing on schooling. But we needed to garner the national support from one another to feel that we have allies in other places that can support us and can assist us with various strategies that might be successful. So we believe that it's very important to have a national movement that supports and encourages the local movements.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Once again, to our listening audience, you've been listening to Beth Altwerger, the founding member of Save Our Schools, and she has discussed with us just exactly how all of this got started. and how important a national conversation is. We're going to now be listening to SOS Steering Committee member David Green. And, Bess, we want to thank you for taking time from the conference to come and talk with us on the New Orleans Imperative this morning. Good morning, David. How are you?
Morning, Ray. How are you been?
I'm okay. Save Our Schools, the organization, let me repeat this call-in number because sometimes our listeners, I'm sorry about this. If you wish to call in to a question or comment, could you please call in at 504-260-9265. That's 504-260-9265. Yeah, David, could you share with us just exactly what is, are the principles and what direction the Save Our Schools organization is going in? I know we have adopted some principles and that are very, very important to the integrity of public education. Can you share with us just exactly the vision for Save Our Schools in terms of public education in this country?
Sure. Overriding everything is our concern that the people who have the most to gain or lose from how public education is done in this country have a voice in that effort. The individual principles are inclusive of all the groups necessary, and the individual principles basically are saying that, A, number one, you cannot have adequate public schools unless you have adequate funding that's both adequate and equitable. And so when you take a look at funding policies and state law, we have to kind of take a direct look at how those right now, based upon property taxes, have created inequity in our schools. The second piece has to do with curriculum and who determines what that should be. And again, the voices that should be developing curricula are teachers, students, parents, community members, not people in D.C. or state capitals necessarily, unless they're representative of those groups specifically. Tangential to that, obviously, is the fact that parents and communities and teachers need to be part of the policymaking. And when we take a look at how policies have been conducted over the last 10 years, or actually probably a little bit longer than that, people who are determining how education should be done in our country are not listening to those people whose voices needed to be heard the most. And that's what we're trying to do, make sure those voices are heard. And most recently, we've added a fifth principle having to do with maintaining and sustaining the professionalism of our teachers on the same level that we consider the other professions such as medicine and law that are increasingly at the bottom line in terms of who we are and what we are as a country. And so all of that has to be looked at because a lot of that is being destroyed by privatization and by budgetary excuses for privatization.
So when let's go back to voices, because I think it's very, very important, particularly for our listening audience, which is mainly New Orleans. As you well know, I know you and Bess well know, most of New Orleans has a lot of charter schools, which are most of the schools are managed by private self-appointed boards. How is that detrimental to public education, and how are voices being eliminated across the country? People are being cut out. Could you share
our founding fathers
your thoughts on that?
Understood that education was a local issue. What happens now by the use of charter schools that seem to be more corporate-based and privately-based is that their agendas may not match and usually don't match what the needs are of the people in the communities they have come to paternalistically save. And so we have to be very wary of that. There are locally developed public schools that understand very well what is necessary, and they don't have a title charter school to them. They might be called community schools, and that's something that's being taken away because, again, it comes down to the idea that who's in charge of making the decisions. I have no, you know, when you call a school a charter school, originally that came from New York City, and it was the idea that a charter school would be developed jointly between teachers and community members to see what was necessary in that particular community to improve the education of the kids in that particular community based upon their socioeconomic needs. That's been usurped, and that's what it needs to go back to. And, you know, I've been to New Orleans a couple of times, and I understand what's going on there, and I know there's one school there that has attempted to do that. It's called the Blair Grocery School, trying to build something out of nothing out in the Ninth Ward. And to me, that's what a charter school should be, not a corporate entity.
So getting back to the principles, and let's, because I think the first principle you talked about was funding.
Yes.
Could you kind of talk about funding, particularly as it relates to the Race to the Top grants that have been given out across the country?
Bribery to the top. And basically, it's the carrot instead of the stick. So the federal government, with the help of governors and legislators all around the country, have decided that, federal money is important because we can't find enough local money to properly fund of all of our schools. So the federal government, through Race to the Top, has created this competitive edge to everything. And the competition is based upon how well you succeed in complying with their criteria, which is not locally determined. And so governors and state legislators have chomped at the bit to get to the carrot and have neglected to ask the people who are actually in the schools whether or not they want to do that. The problem is that local school districts and local schools understand that, you know, you can't necessarily say no to $250 million. The problem is the strings attached to that money. The basic problem comes down to, well, how do you fund schools? And how do you get away from the basic tendency of states to fund schools based upon property values and the inequities that's created? In California, they basically, by Proposition 13, God knows how many decades ago, basically said, well, we're going to underfund everybody, so that makes everybody equal. That's a pretty extreme approach. In order to maintain, I believe, a maximum increase of taxes of like 0.1%. So it's a great place to own property and not be taxed, but it's become a lousy state for public schools. In New York State, except for major cities that have a budget, unfortunately, controlled by mayoralty, as is in Chicago, the rest of the state districts are dependent entirely on how much real estate value the homes and businesses in those districts have, and that leads to greater inequality and inequities.
Okay, you're listening to Beth Altwerger and David Green from Save Our Schools, and they're talking about what Save Our Schools is, the principles around funding, principles around voices, and the principles around professionalism. If you'd like to call in and make a comment, you can call in at 504-260-9265. That's 504-260-9265. And we're going to be discussing exactly what this organization is doing, and you can ask any questions as it relates to that. Given the fact that there are a couple of you guys or three of you guys in the room, in the conference room right now, I'm going to ask you to speak one at a time. And this question is for Beth and David to respond to. What do you see as the future of Save Our Schools, and how important is it moving forward in, you know, as it relates to these corporate reforms that are sweeping the country? Could you go first, Beth, please?
Well, I think that what we're hoping to achieve is a network of educators and parents and communities across the country that are working together and planning both local actions as well as national actions to try to advocate for our principles. And we do already have what's called information coordinators. And if people go to our website at saveourschoolsmarch.org, they will find whether there is an information coordinator in their local area. They can volunteer to be an information coordinator. And in that way, you will be able to be apprised of all of the new events and important issues being discussed nationally and some actions that we'll be taking. But we hope to really change the conversation and to impact the policies. I mean, we're very serious about our mission. We see this as potentially a national crisis. And it's a crisis to the very foundation of a democratic society. When you lose public education, you are really losing the foundation for building a society that's based on social justice and democracy. So we take this mission extremely seriously, and we hope to really help coordinate many different groups and organizations that are working along with us.
Okay, David?
Yeah, that's three parts to my answer. The first part is that a year and a half ago, I was in Washington, D.C. with 5,000 other people, not just teachers, parents, grandparents, students of all ages, people who came together and understood there is a crisis in this country. Our founding fathers, as I said earlier, understood that you cannot have a democracy without an informed citizenry. If we don't work to maintain our public education system, we're going to lose the ideal of democracy our founding fathers originally had. And part of it is communication, and Beth mentioned our website, and Beth mentioned information coordinators. There are a lot of things going on in this country that a lot of people don't know about. There is a majority of school boards in Texas where the testing program began that are now up in arms because after 15 years of it, while George W. Bush was still governor, they recognized that the data shows this stuff is not working. There are movements like this all across the country, school boards, superintendents, principals, teachers. There's an organization in New York for that, who have petitioned, and I believe that the last count was approximately 1,300 administrators and principals who are saying this stuff does not work. This is happening in all across this country. There are organizations like Parents Across America who have all of this information at their fingertips. And what we want to do is we want to be able to bring these voices together, to use the word that you used before, and allow for those actions that are taking place all across the country to be heard and to be amplified by hundreds of thousands of voices across the country. And that's our goal.
Let me ask this question, and I want to shoot this question back to Beth. One of the issues, Beth, is the closing of schools. And what we're finding that's happening in cities is that either state departments or the local boards, or even in some cases, like in the situation in New York, the mayor is determining that schools are failures and schools are closing. And that seems to be a big problem. Could you kind of address that and talk about Save Our Schools and its position on, you know, just closing schools as we see it randomly happening, and sometimes very partially across the country?
The school closings is a major concern of those of us in Save Our Schools. This is happening in cities all across the country, and it's no accident. This is a definite strategy. And it's connected with the testing issue that I mentioned earlier. Schools are considered or are deemed to be failing. They close the school. In many of these cities, those schools are actually just reopened under the auspices of a private for-profit education management company. And instead of putting the money into smaller schools and supporting the teachers in those schools with more resources, they close the schools. So we have children that are traveling long distances, passing by possibly their own former public school, that cannot be admitted or for whatever reason have not been allowed to attend the new charter, and traveling across the city to go to another public school. They use the whole idea of parent choice in a very devious way, because if children are not accepted into a school, either they did not get the right number in a lottery, or they do not meet the qualifications, or for whatever reason they are not considered to be easy to educate because they need special services or whatever, they can be denied access to that neighborhood school that is now a charter. There are thousands of schools across the country that have been closed with these strategies. And parents are up in arms about it, and we need to, you know, organize and unite to stop this travesty from occurring.
Yeah.
David,
I want to make this a little bit of a bigger picture scenario as well.
Go ahead.
A lot of this comes from international competition, and Thomas Friedman's understanding about the world being flat economically. There's an organization called GERM, which is a great acronym. It's called the Global Economic Reform Movement, and it was created in order to deal with the internationalization of corporations. And they decided that they were going to have to internationalize education at the same time to fit their economic needs to provide workers for the new factory models and the new economic model that has obviously become what we now call 21st century, which is a name being used way too often that disguises a lot of this policy. So they talk about bad schools and bad teachers, and then they close bad schools and fire what they call bad teachers. But when you actually take a look at the data, and that's what they keep driving at is data points and data collection. When you take a look at the data and you take a look at how we do internationally, because our poverty rate is so high, we do miserably. But when you take out the poverty rate, as PISA, the international organization that actually measures the various various education systems across the world, we match Finland, we match South Korea, we match Singapore in every single test that they do when you take out for poverty. So what this has become, instead of dealing with providing the necessities to create the equitable education that we've been driving at, they're closing schools and replacing them with charters, and many of them are profit, and many of them, even if they're not for profit, the people who run them are getting exorbitant incomes to do this. And so it's really become an excuse to cut budgets and to slash the biggest portion of education budget, which is labor and labor costs. And then there are all these other policies that come about as a result of that, by replacing high-quality, highly professional teachers with TFA Corps members who are there for 2 years and then move on. And basically what you have is a transient substitute teacher system replacing a career system of committed professionals. So basically what we're trying to say is that Save Our Schools really isn't is all of our principles, but it's really the idea of we need to understand that we do a lot of good things in this country. Finland's turnaround, and everybody writes about Finland, and we know it's 4% poverty rate, and we know it's homogeneous, but Finland turned itself around from having one of the worst education systems to one of the best simply by taking what we did in the 1960s and 70s and making it part of their national system. As a result, they have the best qualified teachers. It's the most highly respected profession in that country. And what they basically understood is when you save our schools, which is what they did, they saved what worked and improved it, not destroyed an entire system, which is what we're facing right now.
Rick, now, I'd like to follow
the other,
up
the other
on
thing
it.
I want to ask you guys about vouchers. And, you know, there are several authors and researchers who claim that vouchers and charters are basically the same thing. Could you guys, and maybe we can start with you, Beth, could you talk about the vouchers in this country, and does that detract from public education like charters?
Well, I think the voucher movement was promulgated by corporate America, and I following up on what Dave said and connecting it to the vouchers, I think most people don't realize that it is not the people, it is not even the politicians who are really at the heart of and who initiated this the current education policies. It's really the corporate sector. Groups like the National Council on Education and the Economy, ACHIEVE, that's running the Common Core State Standards right now, and the next generation of national tests. What I think is going on is that they want to control the dollars that are being budgeted for public education and divert those public funds to private coffers. And one way that they're doing that is through vouchers, so that if each child receives a voucher that is supposed to be equal to their what's budgeted for them as an individual in the public sector, they can use that to enrich the pockets of private companies that are and private schools that are trying to compete with the public dollars. The problem is there are several problems. One is that those vouchers rarely in private schools cover the tuition, and so that the access to some private schools is often not an option. And it also drains the public schools of the money that they need to run their schools in a quality way, so that you're going to have a system with vouchers where the vast majority of children are left in the public school system that is then completely underfunded, under-resourced, and doomed to struggle. And diverting that money that would have supported those public schools to private charter companies that are going to run those schools the way they want, often without public or parent input. We've used the term corporate education reform to try to drive home the idea that we, the people, are no longer at the heart of public policy and education. It is the corporations, and they have both short-term goals and long-term goals. Those short-term goals have to do with profit. They see a huge amount of money to be gained and diverted into their pockets, but also, as David said, long-term goals, which is to reshape the workforce so that they can continue to be globally competitive in the global marketplace. And we have to question what is the purpose of public education? Is it to enrich the corporations, or is it to create a solid, stable, socially just, democratic society? I think that is the key question everyone needs to ask.
To follow up on the question of vouchers, right? Vouchers are an old idea. They've been supplanted by charters. Vouchers were tried, tested, and basically refused all across the country, with the exception, I believe, of southern states where the voucher system was somehow used to allow racially motivated decisions about where children will be sent, so that if a white family, for example, did not want their student to go to the local public school, which might have been predominantly African American, here was an opportunity to send them somewhere else, a private school that better suited their needs, to try to be more euphemistic. The other thing about vouchers is that, once again, that becomes part of this competitive nature that schools should not be about. The Finns are very vocal And again, I use them as the model because everybody looks to them as one of the best school systems in the world right now. They are very vocal about how they made a very strong and premeditated decision to move away from the competition and competitive nature of the school systems that are being pushed by GERM to a more cooperative and innovative one, where schools don't compete against one another. They cooperate, and when one school comes up with an innovation, they have found how to share those innovations system-wide instead of having each school saying, no, this good idea is mine, you can't have it, because if you have it, more people will take their voucher money and go to you and will be closed. That's no way to run a school system.
Yeah, but, you know, when you mention competition, isn't that a problem in the fact that, you know, we have this market-driven system, this corporate-driven reforms, and isn't competition a part of corporate America, you know, protecting your secrets of success? Isn't that problematic just in the whole system of itself of corporate reform?
Yeah, interestingly enough, in the 1980s, the American automobile industry was slammed because it was not competitive enough with the Japanese, who had surpassed us in terms of quality and everything people wanted in their cars. When we examined the issue and said, well, why are the Japanese corporations so much more ahead of ours in terms of that? Why are American cars not being purchased as much as the Japanese cars were? What they found was that there was an idea and a policy that was in corporate structure of Kaizen, K-A-I-Z-E-N, which basically meant listen to the ideas of your workers because we're all in this together, all right? And because there was that concept of all listening to the workers, one of the things that every worker had on a factory line is that if they had a problem with the way something was done on the line, they could shut it down and it would be fixed, because they understood that the cooperative nature between the people who are the grunts on the ground and the corporate executives was more important in the success of the organization than anything else. We weren't following it. The irony is that policy was brought to the Japanese by an American industrialist back in the 1950s, who wrote about that concept in the late 40s. And so it's kind of ironic that, you know, in the name of competition, we get all cutthroat about it, when in reality, in the name of competition, my analogy is teamwork. If I'm coaching a team, we want to beat the other team, but we're going to learn how to work together to do it. If we don't learn how to work together, we beat ourselves. And that's what's happening in this country. We are beating ourselves because we're too busy competing with each other and not working with each other to make our schools better.
Well, let me ask you guys another question.
I think what we've lost sight of also is the fact that education is a basic right. It's a basic right of all people. It should not, in my opinion, be involves the idea of competition. We all, as Dave said, need to be working together. If a school has an innovation that's working, they need to share that innovation. We need to make sure that every child receives a fully funded, equitable education. And getting back to countries like Finland, instead of using test scores as a punishment or as a reward, what they make sure is that if there are social factors involved that lead to the need for a school to have certain resources and certain services in place, that they get them. Instead of looking at a school that is struggling and say close it and open it as a private charter, they say this school is struggling. How can we learn from other schools? How can we share the resources of the society so that school succeeds? So what we need to think about is cooperation within the public school system so that we can benefit from one another. If there could be a friendly competition among schools that result for the benefit of all, then that's fine. But the way that competition has worked so far under these policies is completely unfair. There is no even playing field that we're talking about. We have children that are living in utter poverty that need to be supported. We need wraparound services. And then we can talk about friendly competition among schools. But this is,
you know, it's very interesting, and I couldn't agree with you guys more and more. Just to mention to you guys that in New Orleans, the competition is so great that we have one charter school stealing students from other charter schools. When I say stealing, I mean just using some very unethical recruiting things.
Not surprised at all. I want to add a couple of things to the cooperative nature of the more successful systems. Finland, for example, does not have any standardized tests except one. It's an exit exam after leaving secondary school to determine what kind of continued education you're going to have. And that's it. There's no competition because everybody knows they're going to leave their secondary school, and all that test is going to do is determine where their higher education is going to be and what line that higher education is going to take. The other understanding is that what goes on in schools is based upon more authentic assessments. So when we finally figure out how to do this, then we're not going to have people stealing kids from one another. I mean, you know, you talk about New Orleans. I'm sure this goes on there as well, but in New York City, in the areas that I'm more familiar with, you have several schools in one building. And the kiss of death is when a charter school is put into a building that is already inhabited by a public school, because they literally steal the facilities. They have increased funds. And what they'll do is they'll take the library and redo it and make it computer modern, and basically say, well, it's our money, it's our library. And then the public school in the same building has less and less access to it. And then they're giving a failing grade because they can't provide the same kinds of facilities that the charter in the building that will eventually replace them with has done. And it's incredibly obvious, but nobody stops it.
Well, I think what you just described is already happening in New Orleans. We do have several schools in one building. We have a situation which you just described, you know, exactly what you just described, where charter schools are in there with regular buildings, and it's very, very territorial. And at one particular school, the students cannot use the library, and another school, the school's students cannot use the gymnasium because it's all for the charter schools. So I think that happens. But also what we have in New Orleans is the cannibalization of charter, of other, a smaller, weaker charter schools. We find that charter schools are trying to get as many under their wing as possible. They want to grow from one to maybe four charter schools or six charter schools, because this is about volume and this is about the market. And so this whole, you know, competition thing kind of breeds that kind of environment.
It's a hostile competition. It's what Standard Oil did 120 years ago, 130 years ago, in creating the monopolistic system, which eventually had to be broken up by a progressive president who decided that enough was enough and something was going to have to stop.
Okay. We have a caller on line three we're going to take right now. Could you put him on the line, Lee?
Good morning, Dr. Sanders, and good morning to your guests.
Welcome to the New Orleans Imperative again, Mike.
What you all just described is exactly what happened at my old high school, George Washington Carver High School, which basically they brought in a charter that shared the school that now are still in portables, and they've never rebuilt the structure that they've torn down, that they have over $50 million to rebuild that structure. And that's why these people are involved. It's the money. It's they're not motivated by any altruism or any real things of educating kids in the community. The community wanted to be a part of the board, but they did not go along with that. And so the charter agency that they brought in now, they let the school die and said it was a low-performing school. And now that charter association that they brought in, I don't know if it's collegiate prep or whatever, it has some tie-in with Psy Academy. They're going to basically run the school, without any real input from people in the community. And if you're seen as a leader in that community, basically, and I'm just going to put it out there, what those charter associations do is go to that leader or those two leaders and say, well, what you want, try to basically buy them off and make them part and parcel about what they're doing. And I just would like you all to speak to that.
You know,
yeah.
In the city of Chicago, you have a situation, I'm sure you see it in New Orleans, where you have a starving of a school with very few resources going into it. The buildings are dilapidated. They're not suitable for children or for adults. And the school begins to lose its reputation. It begins to lose its quality. And it's a very systematic and intentional decision, because that school then is replaced by a charter that either moves into that building and totally displaces that public school, or it shares the building. And as soon as the charter moves in, then all of a sudden the government finds money to fund that school, build libraries, put in the technology infrastructure that the public school did not have prior. We need to recognize that there is a corporate government coalition or partnership going on here that is that we need to protest and struggle against, because there is a very intentional decision here to feed these companies and to make them succeed. And I'm sure that there will be a consolidation of these companies so that we end up with just a few very, very powerful charter companies in the country that will begin to supplant the public schools.
I'm a former history teacher, and I can't stop myself from going back to what we can learn from what went on in history. And you guys have an old problem. It's called single out the individuals, divide and conquer. That was the case in Birmingham, Alabama. That was the case in every single city that the civil rights movement went on. If you could divide the leadership from the constituents and buy them off, you have a chance at maintaining the status quo that you're seeking. The answer to that is unity. The answer to that is a multitude of voices, and we've seen that work in the past. Interestingly enough, the election of President Obama is an example of that. They seized the opportunity that the new technology enabled them to get an incredible coalition of the voices of the people to get them all to come out and vote and to put him into office. I think that every city, every location has an opportunity to do the same thing, and it's a matter of gathering all the voices so that the schemers cannot single out the leadership and bribe them away.
Okay, now I want to ask you guys another question before we wrap up right quickly, as short a brief answer as possible. Online schools. We've seen that seems to be cropping up also in many cities. We have some online corporations, national corporations, that's under investigation by state and local authorities. Could you give me your opinion on online learning and online schools?
There are several companies that have decided that they can make enormous profits from online education, and to turn public education into an internet program. One corporation is called Wireless Generation, but I know that there are others. And in Miami, this has become a major problem. And, in fact, the teachers' unions are taking this up. I think that a lot of what's going on, whether it be charter schools or online education, is really in great part trying to break the teachers' unions and take the professionalism out of education. And if you don't need a teacher and kids, there are places where you have 60 kids sitting in front of computers. And, you know, children we're talking about, not adults, but students in our public schools sitting behind computers, and that becomes their education. There's no human interaction. And that's not what education should be. I don't know how many parents would condone that if they knew what was going on. That's not where
in addition to it's not what it's supposed to be there. Their performance, just like the performance of Nick Charters, academically is terrible.
The issue is,
but you know, it's like a new fad. It's like, you know, something new.
The technology is a tool,
you know?
And like any other tool, it determines its use is determined by who's holding it, who's wielding it. Too often, these online academies tend to be online lectures. The very thing no one really wants, the very thing students hate. Come on, we all know it works. We were all students once. The Khan Academy, for example, is a series of lectures that everybody's touting. It's all over the place. They're horrible. They're just lectures. But we have to kind of understand that what does work, we can use the technology. When students from different schools use online tools to communicate with each other and somehow solve a problem, for example, two different school districts want to approach the idea of how to end the apartheid situation that divides their neighboring communities, and they work together to come up with a simulation where they can actually create a solution and bring it before their own school boards and city councils to fix it. Now that's using online technology to, I think, a better end.
Well, look, I want to thank you guys for taking time to talk with us about something that is so important. And I want to get, you know, Save Our Schools back on this program. And for my listening audience, these are my colleagues. I am a member of the steering committee. And I think that going to the website and joining Save Our Schools would be very, very important to you and your community. Do you have that exact website, Beth, Dave? Is it just saveourschools.org?
It's saveourschoolsmarch.org.
SaveOurSchoolsMarch.org.
There are many resources on that website. You'll learn a lot about what's going on around the country.
Okay. Once again, thank you, Dave and Beth, for being on the program this morning. I would like to announce to our listening audience that the Louisiana Association of Educators will be having a forum on public education this Wednesday in the New Orleans area at Chalmette Elementary School. That's at 75 East Chalmette Circle. I'll be a guest on the panel. Please come out for that. This program will rebroadcast on the New Orleans Imperative.com. You can listen to this program at your leisure. And once again, we'd like to thank Save Our Schools steering committee members Dave and Beth for talking with us and sharing with us the vision and also the beginnings of, you know, how Save Our Schools actually got started. I think that was very, very informative, and I think that you guys shared some very valuable information from maybe a national perspective, given that most of our listening audience here is people from the southeastern part of the state of Louisiana and a few people from across the country, but basically it's people from the New Orleans area. So I want to thank you guys again for taking time and sharing with us your vision.
Thank you for having us, Ray.
Thanks for the opportunity, Ray.
Okay, we'd also like to thank our sponsors, which is Metro Disposal, Richards Disposal, Fallbrook St. Rock Improvement Association, the Wisdom Reception Center, and the New Orleans Educational Equity Roundtable. We'd like to thank those sponsors for supporting those programs. And we will be back on the air on next Monday at 10 o'clock, where we'll be focusing on, issues related to public education. We'd like to thank you guys for listening, and thank you guys for tuning in. And as I said earlier, this program will rebroadcast on the New Orleans Imperative.org, the New Orleans Imperative.org. And as I mentioned earlier, we will be back on the air on next Monday morning at 10 a.m. We will be back on the air. Thanks again for listening. Joining you shortly will be Talk What You Know with Reverend Littleton and Reverend Jones, and they'll be joining you in a few minutes. Thanks again for listening to the New Orleans Imperative.